nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
So today, you know, before we dive into more of the details of scattering, I'm still talking at a somewhat general level. So the main topic today is this relaxation time approximation, which you saw we used for solving the Boltzmann equation. And if we get done with that, I'll discuss one of the homework problems. But there's a lot of confusion about this. You know, if you read a lot of books, they'll say, well, this is a plausible thing to do. It looks reasonable. And leave it at that. I was in a meeting yesterday with having a research meeting with a senior professor, and he pointed out when the relaxation time approximation was valid. And I said, no, that's wrong. You know, in fact, if you read different books, you'll get different answers about when it works and when it doesn't. If you read very, very carefully, they might not be saying different things. So I'm going to try to clear this up as best I can today. Okay, so we're trying to justify that relaxation time approximation. It looks like a reasonable thing to do, but when can you say? You know, you should at least know when you should be worried that you might get the wrong answer, right? Okay, so we have this Boltzmann equation, right? And we have this collision integral. And we can simplify it by assuming that the final states are empty, and then we have an even simpler collision integral. But both of them are actually pretty complicated. And what we want to do is to represent that by something that looks plausible. We want to say it's minus. The minus sign means any deviation from equilibrium. The system reacts and tries to bring you back to equilibrium. So F minus, this would be F equilibrium. Or it might be something that has the shape of an equilibrium distribution, but it might have a quasi-Fermi level that's bigger or smaller. So it's F minus this symmetric part, equilibrium shape, divided by some characteristic time, which I'm writing now as tau sub F, because we don't know in advance what it is. Before I told you it was the momentum relaxation time. So we'll see where that comes from. And the question is, you know, when can we really use this? And what is this tau F? You know, where does that come? That somehow that tells us some, that's the characteristic time that tells us the time that the distribution relaxes back to its equilibrium shape. But it's also, turns out it's one of those other times too. So I'll just, I'm going to change notation here a little bit, but remember, we write F as a big part with an equilibrium shape and a small deviation. The big part is symmetrical. You know, it's like the equilibrium Fermi function. So if I have a plus P, I have the same probability for a minus P so that no current flows. Right? Everything is symmetric. The deviation, though, and you could just see this from the solution that we got, is anti-symmetric. So the deviation, if it has a positive sign for a plus P, it'll have a negative sign for a minus P. And that's what causes current to flow. So it's the sum of a symmetric and an anti-symmetric part. So from now on, I'll just call this perturbation from the symmetric part FA. So we can remember that it's anti-symmetric. It changes sign when momentum changes sign. Right? Okay. We have to do a little bit of math here, but it's worth going through so that we know when we can use this assumption. Okay, I'm going to start by assuming Boltzmann statistics because it makes things a little easier. So this is our collision operator, in scattering minus out scattering, right? Makes physical sense. So I'm going to write F as a symmetric part plus an anti-symmetric part. So I just expand it out that way. Okay, but in equilibrium, all we have is a symmetric part. And detailed balance says that scattering has no effect in equilibrium. Because, you know, every scattering from here to there is balanced from there to here. Right? So that's zero. So it means our collision operator only depends on the anti-symmetric part. We don't need just depends on the small part. Okay, so let's see. We're assuming that we're near equilibrium. So this is either it's an equilibrium Fermi function or it's one that has the shape of an equilibrium with the equilibrium temperature. All right. And we've assumed Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics. Okay. Now, this is a simplification we talked about yesterday, too. You know, and you do this, if you remember Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination in 606, you did something similar to relate the emission and capture times. We take a look at this equation, and we say, what's the relation between these transition rates from P prime to P and from P to P prime? And in equilibrium, we can relate those two because in equilibrium, we have the equilibrium Fermi function, and this sum is zero. Not only is that sum zero, but every term in the sum is zero. That's detailed balance. And that gave us this relation between the two. That's just a statement of detailed balance. And that means there's a relation between S of P prime P and S of P P prime, and it's just given by the ratio of these two Fermi functions, equilibrium Fermi functions. So now we're going to argue that even though we derive that in equilibrium, these transition rates are due to microscopic processes, and you know the electrons don't know that we've applied this. Even if we apply a volt across a small device, the electric field is small compared to the fields that are going to scatter the electrons at the microscopic scale. So we're going to say that applies out of equilibrium too. So now I can take this expression and insert it back in for S of P prime P, and I've eliminated one of them. So I only have one transition rate. Okay. So we just take those two and we simplify it. So let's see. The first term, this is my S of P prime P that I use this equilibrium simplification for. Then I have my F of A of P prime, and then I've got my outscattering rate. Okay. So, okay, now, let me pull out of this FA. FA depends on P. This is like I'm doing an integral over P prime, right? So I can pull this out front. I'm not integrating over P. I'm asking, you know, what is the collision operator for a state P? Right. So I can pull this out front, and I have minus FA prime, and then my sum consists of the first term was S of P, P prime, ratio of these, well, let's see, I pulled a minus sign out front, and then I put this term first, so that's my 1, that's my S of P, P prime, F of P, and then my second term then has the ratio of these Fermi functions. Right. We haven't thrown anything away. Everything is fine. We've just done a little bit of algebra. And what we would like to do is to write this as minus the deviation divided by some characteristic time. This looks awful messy. It's not obvious that we can do this. Now, I can always define it and say this is what it is. This is a definition. And that would define the characteristic time. But in that case, the characteristic time would depend in some really complicated way on the distribution. It means to solve the Boltzmann equation, I need to use this characteristic time, but if the characteristic time depends on the solution, then I don't get anywhere, right? This characteristic time has to be independent of F for it to be useful in solving the equation, right? And it's not at all obvious that this works. In order to justify the relaxation time approximation, we have to show that there are some cases where this works. So, our goal then is to show the cases under which this characteristic time is independent of F. Okay. So to do that, let's take a closer look at this. These are equilibrium Fermi functions. They're symmetric in momentum. If I change the sign of P, I don't change the sign. They're even functions of momentum. Well, we're doing the integration over P prime. So I'm really only worrying about the P prime. The other one doesn't matter. The anti-symmetric part is an odd function of momentum. It changes sign. So when I'm doing these sums over positive and negative P primes, this one won't change sign. This one will change sign. Okay. Okay. So let's use that and see what we can do. Let's assume that we have a scattering process that's isotropic. Like even in momentum, it has just as much probability of scattering from plus P to minus P as from minus P to plus P. You'd say that's symmetrical in P prime, right? Even function of P prime. That's what I'm going to call isotropic scattering. Some scattering mechanisms, when we work them out, we'll see that they're isotropic. Now, if I look at that, well, okay, this is even in momentum. So, you know, when I do that sum, I'm going to get some contribution from the first term. Okay. But if I take an even function, this is even, times an odd function, when I sum over all p's, plus and minuses, that's going to integrate out. So all of this complicated business will disappear. And the characteristic time is just this sum, which we've seen before, that's the scattering time. Okay. So if I'm solving a problem and I can know that physically the scattering process is going to be elastic, then I can justify using the relaxation time approximation and feel nice and good that I can probably trust the answer. So we've assumed near equilibrium conditions because, you know, that's where we have a small deviation from an equilibrium or equilibrium shape. We put that in right at the beginning. We've also assumed Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics. And we found that the characteristic time is just a scattering time. All right. So, all right, we've got one case that we know we can use the relaxation time approximation. Okay. Now, just an aside. This is the scattering rate that we've seen before. That's one of those characteristic times we talked about. If you wanted to compute the momentum relaxation time, you would take the probability that there's a transition from P to some other state P prime, and weight it by the fractional loss in momentum that occurred in that scattering event. The fractional loss would be the initial momentum in some direction minus the scattered momentum in that direction divided by the initial momentum. Right. So that's 1 minus the ratio of Pz prime over Pz. Now again, we're assuming isotropic scattering. This is an even function of P. So when I sum over the first term, I'll get some contribution. But even function times an odd function of P prime. When I do that integration, I'll get zero because I'll have equal areas in positive and negative side. So that term will give me nothing. And we find that when we have isotropic scattering, the momentum relaxation time is the scattering time. There's no difference between the two. So I could say that I can use my relaxation time approximation and that the characteristic time is the momentum relaxation time. That's what I've been doing earlier, but I just pulled it out of the air, right? Okay. All right, so turns out there's one other case, in at least one other case, only one other case that I know about that we can justify this. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not as easy to see. I don't have a simple derivation of it, so some of the details are in the book. But I'll sort of indicate how it comes about. So let's assume elastic scattering. All right, so now it's a different problem. It's not necessarily isotropic. In fact, we'll see that charged impurity scattering is elastic, but it's not isotropic. It has a strong tendency just to deflect electrons by a little bit. It doesn't have an equal probability of scattering them in every direction. So, but it's elastic. So let's see what happens here if it's elastic. We started by assuming Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, but actually this will work for Fermi-Dirac statistics too. I'm just not going to go through that. So if it's elastic, then the length of the arrow P prime, the initial energy is the final energy. The Fermi function only depends on energy. This ratio is 1 for elastic scattering. So we just get this. Okay, now is when it gets a little complicated. We solved for FA, and we saw it always had this form. It was velocity dotted into the generalized force. The generalized force is like the electric field or a gradient in temperature, gradient in quasi-Fermi level. So that's the form of the solution. So if I call the angle between velocity and the electric field, say, theta, then the solution is proportional to cosine theta. So if I want to know what F is at some particular P that gives me that velocity, it's got that function. It's a function of energy times cosine theta. All right, here's where it gets messy, so I'm just going to refer you to the details. If we do that in both cases, I'll have a cosine theta on the bottom, and I'll have a cosine theta on the top. And if you do a little spherical geometry, what I've done here is I've taken an incident electron with momentum P. This is the one that we're trying to figure the characteristic time for this electron coming in with momentum P. So, you know, I can align my coordinate axes in any direction. So if I align them in Z, I align the incident P along the Z axis. The scattered one goes off at some other angle. And the angle between the incident and the scattered is alpha. That's the terminology we're going to use. Now, if we use that geometry, and if we do this sum over the azimuthal angle and the polar angle, you can show with a little spherical geometry, look in the book, that when you do that integral, that what you end up with is that this becomes 1 minus cosine alpha. Okay. What's alpha, remember, is the angle, the polar angle, between the incident momentum and the scattered momentum. So an electron comes in, it gets deflected at some angle alpha. There's an azimuthal angle, you know, around the other direction, but it has equal probability of being directed in any one of those azimuthal angles. Unless it's a magnetic impurity, then it might tend to favor one direction versus another. So this is what we get. So again, this is very nice. There's no dependency on the distribution function. Right? This is a number that we can compute in advance. So it's another case where the relaxation time approximation can be justified and we can compute the characteristic time. And, you know, what is this characteristic time? Well, let's take a closer look at that. So it turns out it's the momentum relaxation time. So remember, it's you take the transition probability, you weight it by the fractional loss in momentum. The initial momentum was Pz. The final momentum then was Pz prime. I aligned the z-axis along the initial momentum. So Pz was just the initial magnitude of P. P prime, well, the angle, the polar angle between P and the scattered P is alpha. So Pz prime is magnitude of P cosine alpha. Still magnitude of P because it's elastic scattering. It hasn't changed energy or length. Then divided by P. So this fractional change in momentum is just 1 minus cosine alpha. So this time is the momentum relaxation time also. So that's why when we wrote the relaxation time approximation, we always said it's minus deviation divided by momentum relaxation time. Because in either of the two cases where it works, it's the momentum relaxation time. Okay. So this is the summary. So, you know, go through that on your own time, but what you should take away from this and remember is that you can use the relaxation time approximation if you're near equilibrium, low field transport. If you have isotropic scattering, then we showed that with Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, you can use it. If you have elastic scattering, it doesn't matter whether it's Maxwell-Boltzmann or Fermi-Dirac. I'll explain why in a minute. You can use it also. And whenever you can use it, the right time to use is the momentum relaxation time. Okay. There's a little more discussion. So if you read about this in various books, you know, you see people discussing it a little differently. It's very common for people to say the relaxation time approximation is valid for elastic scattering. Okay, that's true. Okay. But it's also valid for isotropic scattering. So for semiconductors, when we get to common semiconductors like silicon and germanium covalent semiconductors, there are like two important scattering mechanisms, generally, right? One is acoustic phonon scattering, okay, which is elastic and isotropic, so it works in both counts. The other is ionized impurity scattering, which is elastic but not isotropic, so it works also. So we can calculate the mobility of silicon and gallium arsenide pretty easily with the Boltzmann equation. When we get to three fives, like gallium arsenide, indium gallium arsenide, we'll see that the dominant scattering mechanism is a polar interaction with the phonons. It's called polar optical phonon scattering. It's inelastic because there's a big phonon energy that's involved, and it involves a charge because, you know, these materials have a dipole moment. So whenever it's a charge, you end up getting anisotropic scattering. So for 3-5 materials or 2-6 materials, you can't justify the relaxation time approximation. It makes it much harder to compute the mobility of gallium arsenide than it does of silicon. Now, you'll frequently see people going ahead and doing this. And you'll probably, I mean, it gives you a plausible answer. It might not be quantitatively correct. But at least you want to know when you should worry about your answer that it might not be quite right. Right. Now, I assigned a little homework assignment today. If you repeat the first derivation, the one that was the easiest one to do, you can find out whether it also works for Fermi-Dirac statistics. So see if we can figure out whether the relaxation time approximation works for isotropic scattering and Fermi-Dirac statistics. All right. Then we'll know it. Okay, any questions? I know most of you are probably saying, well, you could have just told me it works, but it doesn't always work, right? And if you've taken a transport course, that's the one thing you know, that sometimes it doesn't work, right? And those sometimes are usually the tough problems that get.
When they are doing experiments with 3-5 and they want a good estimate, what do they do?
Yeah, you know, I should have brought in a reference, and I can do that next. They use... There are simple, relatively simple numerical techniques you can write. There's something called Rhodes method. You just... He's got a nice book chapter in semiconductors and semi-metals in the 1970s. And, you know, it's probably these days, it used to take a little bit of compute time. It's probably a simple little MATLAB script now. And you just don't make the relaxation time approximation. You just numerically evaluate that collision integral. And you can do all the parameters. You can do the Seebeck coefficient, the conductivity, and everything you want to do. But people will do it numerically. Yeah. Okay. All right. So then, you know, just a couple of little things we'll talk about here. One is, it's kind of... We might ask, in the second case, when we have elastic scattering, I said it didn't matter whether there were Fermi-Dirac statistics or Boltzmann statistics. Why doesn't it matter? So if we look at this collision integral, we have these, you know, the final state has to be empty. That's what the term in the brackets is about. And this is a pretty complicated expression. But remember, in the last lecture, when we talked about some constraints on the scattering, on the transition rates, there was this ratio of energy difference between the first state and the final state. If there was no energy difference, then the probability of making a transition from P prime to P is equal to the probability of making a transition from P to P prime. We showed that. Those two processes are equal. That means these two terms are equal. And the first term here, I have an f of p prime times a 1 minus f of p. In the second one, I have an f of p times a 1 minus f of p prime. And now you can see here I'm going to get an f of p prime minus an f of p. And here I'm going to get minus f of p prime f of p. And here I'm going to get plus f of p prime to just drop out. If I have elastic scattering Fermi Dirac statistics, then basically has no effect. This is the collision operator I get. And if I had just ignored Fermi Dirac statistics to begin with, I would have gotten the same one. So for elastic scattering, Fermi Dirac statistics doesn't have any effect. And that's why in the second case, when I showed you that the relaxation time approximation works for elastic scattering, I assumed Boltzmann statistics, but there's no need to, right? Get the same answer in both cases. Okay. Now, frequently people will say, well, the relaxation time approximation describes the outscattering process accurately, but not the inscattering process. So I just want to look at that quickly, just so you can see why they make that statement. Here's our collision operator, and I've gone back to Boltzmann statistics again. And one of the things you'll notice, this is like an integration over p prime. This is f of p. I can pull it out of the sum, right? Because it's a constant. This is what? What is that? Scattering rate? This is a scattering rate, 1 over tau. That's the definition of 1 over tau. So the second term is nice and easy. We can evaluate this. We just do an integral once we know S of PP prime and we get this time. So the second term is fine. The first term is more difficult. This concerns the scattering in from some other state, and we have to know the probability that all those other states are occupied, meaning we have to know the answer. We have to know the solution of the Boltzmann equation before we can calculate this in-scattering process. Now, if I look at the relaxation time approximation, it was minus the deviation from equilibrium over this characteristic time. If I just turn that around, it's F naught over tau minus F over tau. Right? That's what the relaxation time approximation says that the collision operator is. But what we just got for the collision operator was the second term. That represented the outscattering term. Right? No problem there. But this is the thing that gets complicated, right? The relaxation time approximation is implicitly assuming that the in-scattering processes are coming from a known equilibrium distribution. Even though out of equilibrium, that isn't quite true. Now, under those two cases, that ends up being the case. It scatters in as though it was an equilibrium distribution, but not in general. Okay, one of the other things that I sometimes worry about is whether the relaxation time approximation conserves carriers. So here's our relaxation time approximation. Let me make life easy by just assuming tau is a constant. It doesn't depend on energy or anything. The deviation is just the deviation from equilibrium. So if I want to know what's the net effect, I sum the collision operator over all the p's, and I find out, what has happened. So when I sum that, I sum f of p minus f naught of p over tau naught. Now, when I sum f of p over all momentum states, that just gives me the carrier density. I just sum over every state, the probability that the state is occupied, and add them all up. That's the carrier density. This is the equilibrium carrier density. So what I find is that the rate of change of f is minus n minus n naught over tau naught. So that looks familiar, right? That looks like a minority carrier lifetime. There's only one problem. We have not our scattering process is electrons don't disappear. Right? This was supposed to be zero. Remember when we did this properly and we did those double sums and worried about interchanging the indices and things, we showed that the full collision operator conserves particles. This is supposed to be zero. That's why we use this symmetric distribution. Because out of equilibrium, the biggest part is a symmetrical equilibrium shape. It's just that the quasi-Fermi level might be higher than the Fermi level was, so we might have more of them. But the shape is the same. If I do that, when I sum over F, that's N. When I sum over the symmetric part of F, well, the perturbation is small, I can neglect it. That's also N, the first order. So I get N minus N, and at least the first order you get zero. So you have to be careful in some problems that you don't use the actual equilibrium distribution, or you might have particles being created or destroyed when you don't want them to, when you haven't put any recombination processes in. Okay. All right. So that's mainly what I wanted to say about the relaxation time approximation. Yes. Now you will see, you will see very many papers where people use it without giving it a lot of thought. But, now you know a little bit about when you can use it and when you can't. People who give it a little bit of thought, they'll frequently do a numerical solution or do something better if they need to get an accurate answer. On the other hand, it usually gives you results that are plausible and sensible. Quantitatively, they might have significant errors. Yeah.
So, what kind of scattering happens at grain boundaries, say in polysilicon?
Yeah. So, a grain. If you want to know what scattering happens at a grain boundary, then you have to think. How do I describe a grain boundary microscopically? A lot of times there are dangling bonds and charges there, so it could be charged impurity scattering, which is elastic. Then maybe you're okay. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean exactly that you get, even if you cannot justify the RTA, that you get plausible results? You are off quantitatively, but qualitatively you're kind of close. Can you comment on that? How can you get something reasonable if you cannot justify that?
Well, you'll get things like you might get a mobility that's Q tau over M. But the actual mobility might be not be the tau that you put in. If you compute numbers, they'll generally be reasonable numbers. They'll be off, probably by less than a factor of two, typically. So if you're trying to look at trends and things, what happens if I have a smaller effective mass? You'll get a higher mobility, If you ask how does the Seebeck coefficient vary with carrier concentration, you'll generally get the trends to go in the right directions.
But even quantitatively, you're not that far from the real result.
Well, I can't make, 20 years ago when 3.5s were a big research problem, people worried an awful lot about this. And they would, people who were careful would never do calculations on mobility or any kind of transport coefficient in a 3.5 with the relaxation time approximation, because they knew that the errors were pretty big, right? Now, over the years, so there's a lot of phenomena. When I took my first, 606 class, it's probably 1973, my instructor, he got up to the, You know how in a forward bias junction the quasi-Fermi levels are flat? Okay. This was a hot research topic. We spent the rest of the semester on this question because that's the question that he was interested in. There are probably 1,000 papers written by about when are the quasi-Fermi levels flat? What are the errors that are involved? Now all of that has kind of been lost, Now when you read in the textbooks, you assume the quasi-Fermi levels are flat, and if that's not good enough, you run Centaurus and see what the answer is. And, people have kind of forgotten all of that. People used to really know this deeply. I think a lot of that has happened with relaxation time approximation and things like that, too. people worried about this a lot a long time ago, and they knew when it worked and when it didn't work, and they had better answers than I do about how much error does it, you know. But that's kind of all been lost. And now when you read papers, people will just use the relaxation time approximation very frequently without even trying to justify it. They'll just do it. They may or may not be aware that they could get in errors. You'll still see. I mean, people that know how to be careful and realize that it can only be justified under certain conditions, they'll take Rhodes' method or some numerical technique and do it. Right. So. Any other questions?
Is it computationally easy to do a three-dimensional solution for the collision integral using the numerical methods?
Yeah, so you've got to, you're near equilibrium, so that helps a lot. You've got to do these, you have to do these integrations in 3D, you know, but the form of the solution is V dot F, and you kind of know, you know, what its shape looks like. There's a cosine theta in there, and I don't think it's very difficult to do. If you get away from equilibrium, it starts getting much more difficult, and we'll talk about how you do that Monte Carlo simulations. Near equilibrium, it can be very efficient. Is there another?
You said this symmetric Fermi distribution function that to which it scatters. You said it's not the actual equilibrium distribution function. It's still Fermi Dirac, though, but it's just a...
Yeah, so... Right? Yeah, so there's an assumption that we're making. It may be shifted a little bit. But we're also assuming that shift is small, right? But... So let's say I plot my distribution function, and let's say it's Maxwell-Boltzmann. So it's, you know, if I plot it versus some p, it looks like that. And now it's e to the ef minus ec over kt, if I approximate the Fermi-Dirac integral. Okay. Now, I may have more carriers. So the assumption that we're making when we say we're near equilibrium is that the distribution has an equilibrium shape. But I may put the quasi-Fermi level in there instead of the Fermi level, meaning that this thing might be a lot bigger. You know, but its spread will be given by the same temperature. Okay, that's the assumption. Now, in reality, you know, there is this big symmetric part, and there's the delta F means that it's displaced just a little bit. Okay, but that's a small displacement. Yeah. And people worry, you can see relaxation time approximations in all kinds of problems. You know, so in phonon transport, people use it frequently too. And I don't know how they justify it there. There must be ways that you can justify it. Pardon me?
I should probably figure that out.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? All right, I'm just going to quickly go through one of these homework problems. We're going back down to magnetic fields. A lot of times when you talk about the magnetoconductivity tensor, people do it in a much easier way. Solving the Boltzmann equation, you have to be careful. There's a little bit of math involved. There's an easier way to do it. And the easier way to do it is just to think about what happens to an average electron. So let's say there's some average electron that has a momentum P. Then I can write this equation, you know, dp dt, where this now refers to the momentum of an average electron in the semiconductor, is equal to force and electric field and magnetic field. So the picture then is that the force accelerates the electron for some time tau before it scatters. And then on average, it scatters back to zero, and then the force accelerates it again for another time tau. So dp dt, p starts from zero on average, goes up to some value p, and it does it in a time tau, the scattering time. So then you can solve for average p is related to that scattering time this way. And if it's a parabolic band, then that's m times z. Okay. So the key thing is we're not doing a Boltzmann equation where we're trying to figure out how these are distributed in momentum. We're just doing an equation for an average electron. Okay, so now I've got an equation for velocity. That's actually an equation that you can solve. You know, it's a vector equation. You can see I've got velocity on both sides. But you can solve that equation and find out what the velocity is. It's easier if you want to do this in 2D. So if I assume that the velocity has only X and Y components, and if I assume that the B field is pointed in the Z direction, that's a very common experimental condition, then I can just express these, the equation for Vx and the equation for Vy, and we can express that. And then you can see the equation for Vx involves a Vy, and the equation for Vy involves a Vx. So I can take those two equations, and I can just substitute for Vy into the first equation, and I can solve for Vx. So it's not too difficult. And I'll bring this term over here to the left-hand side, and I'll recognize that QB over M is something that has the units of frequency. This is the cyclotron frequency. And we can end up solving, and we get an equation like this for the average velocity. So it's not too much easier than solving the Boltzmann equation. Right? Straightforward. And so I have that velocity, and now current is NQ times velocity, with a minus sign because of the minus charge for electrons. So then I have a simple equation for the current, Jx, and I can do the same thing for the Y component. So we've solved for the currents a lot easier than solving the Boltzmann equation. And if I just write those two equations, I get this magnetoconductivity tensor. Actually, we get something we didn't have before. When we solved the Boltzmann equation, we assumed small magnetic fields so that we ignored this B squared term. We said mu times B squared is much less than 1. But we get that too. So we get this magnetoconductivity tensor. You can see that the off-diagonal components depend on the magnetic field. That gives us the Hall effect. The diagonal components actually also depend on the magnetic field. If you were to go in the lab and crank the magnetic field up, you would see that these diagonal components go as 1 over 1 plus B squared. Right? They have some magnetic field dependence. So the magnetic field affects both the diagonal and off-diagonal components, and if we assume that the magnetic field is small, that's equivalent to omega c tau, much less than 1, then this goes to 1, this is just sigma, and we get back the expression we got before when we solved the Boltzmann equation. Now, it's interesting, we could invert this. So what we have here, in the magnetoconductivity tensor, it relates J and E. So this is a sigma tensor. Okay. We could turn this around and get a magnetoresistivity tensor. And I could just take this equation. So it's got some diagonal components that we can identify here. It has some off-diagonal components. And I could invert this matrix, and I could solve for the electric field in terms of the carrier density. So electric field should be rho times carrier density. So I would get a magnetoresistivity tensor. And I could just evaluate these terms in, knowing the terms in the magnetoconductivity tensor that we've already computed. And if you do that, something very interesting happens. When I'm measuring the resistivity, the two diagonal components turn out to be, resistivity is 1 over sigma, no B field in the diagonal components. The off-diagonal components have a B field. So it's interesting that, if you're doing an experiment and you're measuring the conductivity, the diagonal components depend on the B field. If you're doing this, if you have the same material, but you're doing an experiment and you're measuring the resistivity, not the conductivity, the diagonal components are independent of the B field. And, it has to do something to do with the boundary conditions that you're applying during this. And, I still need to think about a simple physical explanation for why that occurs. But it does occur. So there is no, we would say that there is no longitudinal magnetoresistance. the resistance in of the diagonal components are unaffected by the magnetic field. Hall effect is proportional. Now, when we did this properly, this was not mu n. What was it? It was the Hall mobility. What we've missed by taking a shortcut, and you know, and frequently this is the way you'll see it in books and things, because it's a lot easier than solving the Boltzmann equation. We just picked out an average electron and we solved for an average electron. We missed all of this averaging over the scattering times over all the distribution of electrons. There is a ratio of average value of tau squared divided by average value of tau quantity squared that we've missed, which can be, you know, 1 to 2 or something, right? So we get all the trends right, but we didn't get the whole effect right. Okay.